Welcome to Lady Justice, Women of the Court, a podcast hosted by women state Supreme Court justices and produced in partnership with the National Center for State Courts. In each episode, our hosts Justice Rhonda Wood of Arkansas and Justice Beth Walker of West Virginia discuss the law and its real-world implications for listeners of all ages. Join us for another insightful and inspiring conversation.
Welcome back to Lady Justice, Women of the Court. I'm Justice Beth Walker of the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia, and I'm thrilled to be back with my friend, Arkansas Justice Rhonda Wood. This is an exciting day for our podcast. We have an announcement to make. We've been working on this for a little while and can't wait to talk about it. But before we do that, Rhonda, how are you? What's new?
Oh, boy. I am exhausted, and things have been busy here in Arkansas. And I think you know I'm running for Chief Justice. We are elected in Arkansas for 8-year terms, and there were 4 of us in the race, and I made it to the runoff, so I will be on the ballot in November, and I'm very excited about that. But it was a year of campaigning, and now we're campaigning still to November, so there we go. But very grateful to the voters and excited.
Well, congratulations on, I know that you worked very hard. Judicial elections, as we've talked about on this podcast, are unique and can be a little challenging. Yes. And you had 4 people in your race. And as I understand it, just because we also love to talk about process, if a candidate did not achieve 50% mm-hmm. of the votes cast on Election Day, which was last Tuesday as we're taping this, then there would be a runoff of the top 2 vote getters. Is that how it works?
That's right. And we're nonpartisan in Arkansas. And there are three of us on the court running, plus an attorney. So we pretty much expected a runoff with 3 of us on the court running for that chief position. So 2 of us that are sitting on the court are in the runoff and on the ballot in November.
Well, after November, we will do a podcast to talk about what it's like to run for office with your colleagues. But because it's an ongoing project, we will wait for a future podcast. But what we do want to talk about today is this podcast, our the little podcast that could. Sometimes we've called it, and of course, it was your vision, Rhonda. And we started talking a few months ago about how if we wanted to make our podcast even better. So, do you want to kick off just a little bit of background about that
for those of us that haven't been along? And Anna, I guess you can learn a little bit. But we started this back during COVID. And actually, because my granddaughter, she interviewed at the time, she wanted to interview us, and the Arkansas Department of Education needed content during COVID. When it first happened, there wasn't enough content. So our granddaughter I asked her if she wanted to interview some female justices. So it was myself, Beth Walker, and then at the time, Eva Guzman and Bridget McCormick. So Texas and Michigan we brought in. And we just had so much fun, honestly, probably selfishly visiting with each other during COVID. And we heard favorable feedback. So I said, hey, would you guys want to do this more regularly and as a podcast? So we did. And so now we're in year 4, but Eva left the Texas Supreme Court to run for office. And so then it was the 3. And then Bridget left the Michigan Supreme Court to go to the American Arbitration Association. So then now it's Beth and I. And so then we started thinking about how we wanted to proceed and if we wanted to do things differently. So Beth, I'll let you talk about our next step.
So as our listeners know, we love talking about state courts and how awesome state courts are and state constitutions and how they're all different. And I can't wait to do a little bit more of that in a minute. And we approached actually the folks who are experts about state courts, the National Center for State Courts, to talk maybe possibly about partnering with them on this podcast. In my role as Chief Justice, as I've talked about before, I was Chief Justice in West Virginia in 2023 and also in 2019. And in that role, particularly, I got to know better the work of the National Center for State Courts. They are such, the organization is an excellent resource for state courts and supports just the day-to-day work of courts in so many different ways. For example, last year we had a workload study to enable us to decide how to reapportion, realign our judicial districts. That was in reliance on the data collected and analyzed by the National Center for State Courts. That's just one example. It really is the subject matter expert on what state courts do and the operation of state courts. It helps us respond to emerging trends and events like the pandemic. Artificial intelligence is a current project of the National Center, and also some more that we're going to talk with our guest today about. And so one thing that our podcast and the National Center for State Courts, not that we're, I mean, this is kind of big, we're just a little podcast, and the National Center is, you know, an esteemed organization, but we are bold and unafraid. And so we asked them whether they might like to partner with us. And we have some shared interests in civics education, in finding ways to talk about the importance of state courts, building trust and confidence in the integrity of our state court systems all around the country, and explaining it in a way that people can relate to. So kind of with that is our common goals. This, I am pleased to say, is our very first episode of the new partnership. So Rhonda, tell us a little bit more about how things are going to look just a little different.
So yes, we're very excited. And I first have to sort of thank the Arkansas Supreme Court, because the Arkansas Supreme Court, once we sort of came up with this idea of doing the podcast, then we, you know, I went and asked our chief at the time, well, still is our chief, Kemp, who's retiring, and said, by the way, I have this idea. can we do this and run it? Because we needed to produce it. So we've been producing it out of the Arkansas Supreme Court. And the Arkansas, sort of our, education outreach coordinator has been helping, and we weren't podcast experts. And so, it's been sort of, a process of love and a product of love. And the Arkansas Supreme Court has done that for 4 years and really helped. And now it's time, you know, that this, what do you call it? The little podcast that could, has, you know, decided to join efforts with, the National Center. And so we are rolling out a new logo, and we're very excited about that. We will still have all of our, you know, information, on the same, you know, website on Podbean. Everything will be the same, but there will also be links on the National Center as well. And, you know, our goal has always been to focus on state court civic education and the importance of state courts, and really improving the public perception of the judiciary when it comes to state courts. And I think it's just a natural fit. Like you said, they're experts in that area as well. And so, yeah, we're just very excited about it.
And so grateful that the folks of the folks we've worked with so far have been very patient with us as we release our little project to some folks who have a good bit more expertise in some technical areas that we yes. do not, particularly our logo. So for this first official episode, we have the perfect guest, in my view. Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby is the Chief Judge of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, and, as we'll talk about both of these things, the current president of the Conference of Chief Justices. As we talk, we'll talk about both of those things in a few minutes. But first, Anna, I just want to welcome you and thank you for taking time. I know you have been traveling a lot in your leadership with the CCJ role, in addition to your busy work as the chief judge in the District of Columbia. So hello, say hello and introduce yourself to our wonderful audience.
Well, hello, Beth. It's always good to see you. And Rhonda, what a pleasure to meet you. And congratulations on your, I guess, first leg of your election as Chief Justice in Arkansas. So I can understand the exhaustion you expressed in the beginning. It's my pleasure to be here on your Lady Justice podcast. I introduced myself. Well, I am the Chief Judge here in Washington, D.C. on our D.C. Court of Appeals, which is our highest local court. It, as you all know, the District of Columbia is not a state, but we have many state functions. And we have a population that is the size of or larger than the size of many states. And so the difference with us is that the federal courts are literally right across the street from our state court system. And our DC Court of Appeals is our highest local court. So it would be the equivalent of both of your courts, Beth in West Virginia and Rhonda, your Supreme Court in Arkansas. And I've been the chief judge now for 6 years. It's going on almost 7 years. I'm in the third year of my second 4-year term as chief. And I have been on our court now for 18 years. And then before that, I was on our trial court for 11 years. So I've been on the judiciary, been a part of the courts in DC for now 28 years. Some days it really feels like it, but many days it feels like it was just yesterday. So,
well, so I think one of the things that's interesting about you is we talk about different states are nonpartisan or partisan and how we become, you know, elected to office or and appointed to office. And I was appointed at one stage early on just because there was a vacancy. But my understanding is that you're appointed, if I'm understanding that's right, by the president. But you were, interestingly enough, appointed by presidents of both parties. So if I saw that, you're appointed by President Bush and by President Clinton. So I think we also have that tie because of Clinton having the Arkansas tie. So you have some relationship to Arkansas. But I think that that's really interesting that it speaks to sort of maybe the nonpartisanship nature of you being appointed by both, which I think that's probably fairly uncommon. But is that maybe common in D.C.?
Well, I think it was probably more common before than it is currently. I think it's something I feel really proud about, first of all, because I really think that as judges, we are nonpartisan and we all want to be fair and impartial, and we want to be able to apply the law and the facts of a particular case. And it's really interesting in DC that even though these are our local courts, our appointment process is kind of unique. We do have a local, we call it our Judicial Nomination Commission. And our mayor, our city council, the president of the United States, and the president of our local bar association appoint the members of that commission. And that commission, for each vacancy that occurs on my court, as well as on our trial court, we don't have an intermediate appellate court. The commission selects three names to recommend to the president of the United States, and then the president chooses one of those names to nominate. And then we go through Senate confirmation, but not the Senate Judiciary Committee, like federal judges. We go through the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and the District of Columbia. Interesting committee. and we have a 15-year term. So it is an interesting process. It's supposed to be nonpartisan. I think it usually is because we're not lifetime federal appointees like the federal judges. But there's a process of trying to gain the support of the community. There's a public notice and comment period. And so I think there are lots of other like proxies in that process to make sure that the community really has a say-so in who the judges are that serve the community. We have to live within the District of Columbia, which is another way that we ensure the connection between our judges and the community. We're generally looking for judges who've been involved and active in the bar and demonstrated a commitment to public service. So,
how many total judges are there in the district?
On our trial court, there are 62 judges and 26 magistrate judges. Now, you figure the District of Columbia is roughly about 10 square miles, but we have about almost 800,000 people. And so it's an interesting jurisdiction because it's an all urban jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Then we have 9 judges on our court when we're at full strength, but a big but. We have not had all 9 positions filled in nearly 10 years. And that has been a real challenge. If you sort of think back on what's been happening in the country for the last 10 years, it's made the process, which used to be a little less politicized for our judges because we weren't lifetime appointments, it's made the process just a little slower and made our workload more challenging. Right now we have 7 of the 9 positions filled.
So I'm sorry, Beth, I'm totally interrupting where you're supposed to be talking.
No. I am, as you know, as our listeners know, we are fascinated by like the geeky details of how courts work. And now we have something that's not really a state. I am a little relieved to know you said how many folks live in the District of Columbia, Anna?
It's about over 700,000, not quite 800,000.
Shoot, I was thinking it was going to be bigger than West Virginia, and then I was going to feel kind of inferior, but it's not quite. We are something like 1.7 million, but my goodness, imagine running a court system in 10 square miles, governing 800,000 people. We talk about this a lot on the podcast. In your chief judge role, are you also sort of the head administrator of the DC courts the way that the chief justices are in the states?
Yes and no. Like chief justices in the states, we have a senior court administrator, our chief executive officer of the courts, and then the chief judge. As chief judge of the Court of Appeals, I also oversee what we call our Joint Committee on Judicial Administration that oversees both our court and the trial court. And then there's a chief judge of the trial court who serves on that joint committee along with me as well. So it is, it's a busy court system. And it also becomes very intimate because in the District of Columbia, which is so small geographically, with the judges having to live in the district, it's not unusual to go to the drugstore or the grocery store or be out and about and see someone that you've seen in your courtroom. And actually, I think that's a positive in most instances that we are very much a part of the community. We care about the quality of life and public safety and all of the kinds of quality of life issues that people come to our courts to try to resolve.
And like my friend Rhonda, who was also a trial judge and an appellate judge, you were a trial judge, Anna, and are now appellate. What are your what kinds of cases made up your docket as a trial judge and also then as an appellate?
Well, as a trial judge, our trial court is what we call a unified court. That means it's everything all together as one. We have family, child support, child abuse, unfortunately, child custody, divorces. We have probate, tax, criminal case jurisdiction, civil case jurisdiction at the trial court. And because we don't have an intermediate appellate court, there's what we call appeal as of right from all those kinds of cases to our court. So it's a pretty busy docket on our court of appeals. And, you know, I like the mix of issues. So at any one time, I might have several criminal cases, child custody case. And then we also have the bar discipline cases, because like many other state Supreme Courts, we oversee the admission and discipline of lawyers to practice in the District of Columbia. So I used to joke, I don't know, I used to watch episodes of I Love Lucy when I was a little girl with my grandfather. He loved that show. And there was this one episode of Lucy and Ethel in the candy factory working on a conveyor belt. And somebody hit the fast forward and the candy just kept coming from every direction. That reminds me of life on our Court of Appeals sometimes. At first it seemed really calm coming from the trial court. I'll only have a few cases. And then it's like someone hit the fast forward button and it is a busy docket.
That's a great way to describe it. I haven't thought about that, but I'm picturing that episode right now. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm trying to think about, I'm still trying to think about, because I think if I remember, you guys sit in panels. And so I was trying to think of how, if you have a court of nine and you'd sit in panels of three, but if you're down two, I was trying to think of what a nightmare that would be to not have a full set for 10 years. I'm sorry, I'm going back, but from an administrator, because, you know, both of you have been, you know, Beth has been chief twice and you're chief. I'm thinking that is such a task to have to deal with.
It is a challenge. And it also means that we can't resolve as many cases, because you just can't constitute mm-hmm. as many panels as you can mm-hmm. when you have nine judges. It made it difficult because we also sit on bonk, as the which mm-hmm. is our fancy term for all nine of us, when sometimes there's a split between the three judge panels and parties want to get our full court to look at an issue that is an issue of importance. When we've been down judges consistently, sometimes it makes it harder to agree. If you have a judge or two that are recused, you can't get a quorum in order to be able to agree to go on bonk. So I hope we got up to eight for a short period. And then one of our colleagues was nominated to the federal bench here. And so we have two names that have been recommended by that commission I mentioned earlier to the president, and the president is in the process of trying to decide who to nominate for these vacancies. But you're right, we try to mix up the panel so it's not the same three judge panel every time. So that becomes more and more challenging.
Well, I have no doubt you probably manage that as effectively as you can. You have a way, Anna, of being able to bring people together and talk about difficult issues in a great way, at least that I've observed. So we also love talking about women in leadership, and we're just thrilled that you could set an example for a long time public servant in the District of Columbia. But I have to know, so is DC, I know the District of Columbia is not a state, we've talked about that, but it's kind of like a state. Does it have a constitution?
We have what we call our home rule charter. The District of Columbia got local home rule. This may surprise some folks. It didn't happen until 1973. And prior to that, there was a group of three commissioners that were appointed by Congress to oversee the governance of the District of Columbia. So we have a home rule charter. There has been off and on ever since D.C. got home rule, and even before, some efforts to make it a state. So a statehood movement, if you will, in D.C. And so there is the correct term is sort of a proposed or unofficial constitution that members of the statehood movement have prepared. But there have been a number of bills and efforts in Congress to get it moving, but it hasn't yet come to fruition. I know that folks haven't given up. Some folks will continue that effort and we'll see what happens. But recent efforts have not been successful so far.
Wow. Well, what an interesting sort of structure in terms of hybrid federal state. I can think of a bunch of other questions. Rhonda, what I think I haven't alternated very well. So what other questions do you have about the governance?
No, I think it's really fascinating. The other thing I was looking at is your development of like your code system and your statutory background. It seems very different than what we're used to in Arkansas and West Virginia. Could you explain that a little bit? Because we have people from all over the United States that listen to us. And so I think that's unique also.
Oh, well, it's great to talk about, I guess you might laugh if I call it my hometown, because I guess if you don't live here, you see what you see on the news. But, you know, there are wonderful communities and neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. And even though it's such a small geographic area, the variety is very stark. I mean, you have some of we have the largest bar, meaning largest number of attorneys admitted, third largest number of attorneys admitted to the D.C. bar, if you could believe that. Some people might believe it. but we also, and we have some neighborhoods that are extremely well wealthy, but you also have pockets of sustained and generational poverty right within this microcosm or small geographic area. We have a DC prior to home rule. Our precedent, if you will, was governed by the state of Maryland. We followed state of Maryland's law. So it's really only after 73 and 76 that we began establishing our own case precedents for specifically for the District of Columbia. And then we have a DC code and our own DC code legislative history. So if you go to the Atlantic Reporter, the cases from the DC Court of Appeals are in those bound volumes there. So
who enacts the code? Yeah. Sorry.
Our DC District of Columbia Council enacts legislation. And in fact, the big, it's been in the news. There's been a uptick in certain kinds of crime in the District of Columbia, which is it's frustratingly sad and concerning for all of our criminal justice system, the courts and prosecutors. And the council just passed a major piece of criminal code reform. I think our criminal code that we followed predated home rule and really hadn't been amended for almost 100 years. So the DC council enacts that code. But then any legislation that they adopt has to then go to Congress. And there's a period of within which Congress can, if they want to, make proposed changes or amendments or could veto it or not. That period, review period, typically been pretty quiet. In other words, not much happened once it went up there. You just waited for the time period to pass. Mm-hmm. But about a year and a half ago, much more... very different criminal code reform bill was sent to Congress that wasn't well received at all because some felt it was a little too lenient at a time when certain kinds of crime was on the rise in DC. So it is interesting that you could imagine your Arkansas legislature passing a code and then it would have to get congressional approval. That sounds like not how we anticipate sort of state federal jurisdiction to work, but it's one of the unique features of the District of Columbia not being a state. So very interesting.
So you mentioned it is your hometown. Are you were you raised in the district?
I was born two sisters, so I'm the oldest of three girls, and my mom and dad shortly after they got married they came to Washington D.C. My dad had his associate degree, but he wanted to go to finish his four-year degree at Howard University, which is a historically African-American university here in D.C. And it was at a time of a lot of change in our country, the early years of the Civil Rights Movement. And my mom was a school teacher, and so she came and joined him. And two of the three of us were born here in D.C. And so I really do think of it as my hometown. And I will say one of the things I say, not to bring the mood down, but to say how much change in my lifetime I've seen. But at the time I was born in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. was segregated, legally segregated based on race. So there were certain stores that African-Americans couldn't shop in or places that couldn't go or transportation they couldn't ride on. And I think about that on some of my toughest days at work when I go into our courthouse library, which I love, and just think, only in a country like our country could I be standing where I am today after being born where I was not that long ago. I'm not going to say that how many years, but it really wasn't that long. And so I've seen change and I've seen the power of the law to bring about fairness and justice for all people. And I feel like there's more work that we need to do. And that's why we need good judges and committed lawyers to make sure that our country continues to be the great country that it is. And our courts, I'm the first to say we're not always perfect, but I feel like we're the best judicial system I've seen in the world. And it's because we keep pushing to make sure that it does and serves the people the way it's supposed to.
Wow, that's really inspiring. Thank you for telling us that background. I love hearing about that. And obviously, you've served with such amazing distinction in your beloved home city, home district, home zone, whatever the appropriate not state term is, or maybe you're pro. I'm not going to ask you to take a position on the state versus no state issue. I would not ask. You probably couldn't take a position on that, but as if that weren't enough, you are now, as I mentioned in the intro, the president of the Conference of Chief Justices. And to be honest, when I first became Chief Justice in 2019, in my third year on the Supreme Court, I wasn't entirely sure what the Conference of Chief Justices was or did. And so tell us about that organization and your role as president.
Well, I think the Conference of Chief Justices is a great organization. One of the things that's so great about it is I met and continue to meet such wonderful people. Like Beth, you and I became friends through work at the Conference of Chief Justices around issues that we care about that affect our state courts. And It is the conference for the chiefs of the highest courts of all 50 states and the District of Columbia and the other U.S. territories like Puerto Rico, Guam, and I think American Samoa and Marshall Islands. I hope I didn't leave anyone out. But
Virgin Islands, is that another one?
U.S. Virgin Islands.
I don't want you to forget anyone.
No, thank you. And it's a wonderful group of peers who are sharing and the same challenges that we each face in our home jurisdictions. And what I like about it is that we are we're focused on improving state courts, and we look at big picture issues. And so, you know, whether you happen to be from what folks might deem a red state, blue state, or purple state, what I like and love about the Conference of Chief Justices is that we can sit around the table and really talk thoughtfully about challenges that courts face. And, you know, we talk about in CCJ or Conference of Chief Justices that, you know, 95% or more of all people who ever go into any court anywhere in the country go into a state court. And so we need to be always focused on how we can better serve people. And so there are a couple of examples that come to mind about why it's so great. One is March 15th, 2020. If you think back, you may remember we had this thing called the COVID-19 pandemic that impacted all kinds of functions. But I found myself as chief judge sitting there thinking, okay, it doesn't seem like more hand sanitizer is going to solve this issue. Governments are closing. The federal government, the local government, airports are closing. What am I supposed to do here? I don't even know where to begin. And I the first thing that came to mind is my two closest neighbors are the chief justices in Maryland and Virginia. And I picked up the phone and called the then chiefs of both of those courts and said, you guys didn't have any clue. How do we handle this? And then I called my colleagues from Michigan and Texas, and we began sharing, here's the order I issued. Here's the order. Here's how my court is handling it. And the Conference of Chief Justices created a rapid response team. So you didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And there was some consistency, even though each state is independent and has the ability to handle their issues according to the needs of the people that they serve. There were some consistent things that helped. So that was one area. I mean, behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse, we see that. And I saw that as a trial judge in every kind of case, from family cases to criminal cases to civil cases to probate cases. So mental health, substance abuse, learning best practices for how to, what the courts can do to address these issues. And Beth, you and I had a wonderful experience. One of the things I wanted to focus on during my year as president of the conference is trying to increase and rebuild and restore public trust and confidence in state courts. And what we did was, may sound like something interesting for judges and courts to do, but we actually had a consultant work with the Conference of Chief Justices to do focus groups. You know, you usually see those as marketing tools for a new product, like a new cereal. Who likes this kind of cereal. But we did it to learn more about what people all around the country were thinking about courts. And Beth and I got to sit in behind the double glass to watch a group of people from the community talk about the courts, what they knew. And in some instances, it's a weird feeling. I mean, we like to think that we're fair and we're working so hard and we do it because we care, but that's not always how people perceive it. And so, well, one thing that we learned that was concerning is that most people, we did old, young, different racial and ethnic demographics, Northeast, Southwest, Midwest, all across the country. And everywhere we went, people felt like, well, if you're rich or if you're a big shot of some kind, you get different justice than if you're just an ordinary person. And that's just the opposite of what we want people to feel about courts. And that was very concerning. And so we're looking at what we can do better. When people heard, interestingly, that we actually have mental health treatment courts and drug courts and veterans courts that help connect people with in those categories with services in the community. Those things made people say, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. And the other thing is, it was very important for people to know that state court judges are accountable. We have in every state a code of ethics that judges are required to abide by. And when you don't, there can be consequences. And so that seemed to give people a better feeling about more confidence in the work that judges and state courts do.
I think that, Anna, you've hit on it, that it, a lot of times that it may not be that they've had negative experiences across the board, but it's just that they don't have the information about courts and they don't really know everything that's available and all the services and how courts function. And so that's sort of, you know, comes back around to why we were doing the podcast, is trying to get that information out there to say, here's all the work courts are doing. So, I mean, Beth and I feel very passionate. And so it sounds like that's where you are too, is that that's sort of our job, is to go out there and educate the public and tell them that these things are available and that this is how the court works. And to do that, because we want to instill public confidence and we want people to turn to the courts when they need help with a problem, not run from them. So right. I just commend you for being willing to step up in that role and taking it on and all the, on top of the heavy burden that you already have to sort of lead that nationally is a big effort. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. And Rhonda, you know, this podcast, it's really, really important, because courts are baffling to many people and to even attorneys and judges trying to figure out which court does what and how I file this, and why do you call it, why do you use those words to describe something that's simple? During the pandemic, we actually changed a lot about how courts operated because we had to. And some of those things are really good things that we've kept in place, like the ability to do some court matters remotely. Mm-hmm. People like that. And we do our oral arguments for our Court of Appeals, and we live stream them on Zoom. And I remember telling my son, a young adult himself, that he could watch my cases on YouTube. He just got the biggest kick out of that. I never thought that we could be phenomenal. But, you know, something else you said, Rhonda, sticks in my mind, that we need to be in the community more, telling and sharing what courts do. And letting people know that we're also willing to listen to their suggestions about how things are working. And that's an important piece. That was an important takeaway for me, that people, when they feel like you're genuinely listening to their suggestions about mm-hmm. how courts are impacting their lives, and that you're willing to do something about it if they make a suggestion, that goes a long way. That goes a long way. We had our landlord-tenant court, for example, was an area where it's a busy court calendar. It's very tense because people are worried that they may get evicted or lose their housing. And we, at one point, this is an older example, but at one point years ago, we would have the courtroom clerks check in all the people. And then once everybody was checked in, then the judge would take the bench. And that seemed to make sense until you thought about it from the perspective of the person who took off work to arrive at court at 8:45, which was on their notice, not realizing the same time was on 200 other people's notice. And so to them sitting there and then seeing the judge come in when the judge was told to come down, because that didn't look right. It looked like, wait a minute, why was I here? And so one thing we changed years ago was the judge comes in first and says, welcome everyone. This is what you should expect. This is how the case docket is going to run. There may be a few delays here, but this is why. This is who you can talk to. Changes like that, which we heard from people who had been to the courts. We also hear sometimes good things that work well. People like the video that we do for jurors in our jurors lounge. So that two-way engagement is important. We have to share more about how things work, but we have to let people know that they can also share with us about ideas that might make things work better.
And as you said, you know, it's easy as a judge to be, you know, you talked about our ethical obligations and, you know, we have to be very careful about the things we say, positions we take. And I think some judges interpret that, and it's human nature and it's natural to say, well, I'm just not going to talk to anybody about anything and I'm going to withdraw. And, you know, that's one of the lessons we learned in West Virginia is we do need to be out, as we say, out and about in the community, available to talk to folks who come to the Capitol and visit, available to go to whatever events and just listen to what people say about our courts. Because as you said, Anna, sitting in that focus group in Virginia, listening to a group of, you know, random citizens talk about their perceptions of the court, that is humbling and informational all at once. And we probably don't do it enough, which is, again, as Rhonda said, why you're such an inspiration. You are so open and, you know, out there listening, you know, in your community, talking about leading your community, of course, as the chief judge. So I hope that you inspire some other woman now, maybe as a student in the District of Columbia, coming through school, maybe happens across our podcast and says, well, I could do that too.
And she can. And that's what, I think that's what's so great about just the podcast getting out there and inviting folks to sit down and chat with us, which is what it feels like with a podcast to connect. And I think there's something special about judicial leadership that, you know, we talk about congressional leadership or legislative leadership. We talk about leadership from the perspective of the executive branch, you know, the president or the mayor. But there's an important role, I think, for judicial leaders to play. And if judges are not out talking about the importance of justice and the importance of courts, then I can't think of who is better than us to talk about why fair and impartial courts are important, why people should care about jury service, and all the things that we do in our courthouses every day to try our best to make sure that people feel that they receive fair and equal justice. Those are important things for us to say. We know we try to do it every day, but I think it's important to share it with people.
Well, it's we are so grateful for you joining us on this inaugural partnership episode and for being supportive of this effort of ours to expand our reach. And I could sit and talk to you for a while more about the District of Columbia. And maybe we'll do another episode because I feel like we've maybe just scratched the surface, but we are going to turn our way toward our concluding whimsical part of the podcast, which is our lightning round. This is where we give quick answers to questions that may or may not have anything to do with the work we do or today's topic. Anna, we appreciate you being willing to do this with us, but we won't make you go first. So we'll answer each question In this order, Rhonda, and then Anna, and then me. And our first question, inspired by someone who drives around the District of Columbia, I want to know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is the best, how good of a driver are you, Rhonda? You've been driving around Arkansas.
I've been driving around Arkansas. I would say I'm a 10. My husband would say I'm a 2. Because we have been fighting about who's been driving around Arkansas. I'm just going to be honest about that.
Across Anna, the whole state. Wow.
Anna, where do you land?
Oh, I think I am probably about an 8. I hear my son talk about me when I'm driving. He's like, I think he'd like me to go faster, and others probably would like me to go slower. So I give about an 8 plus.
I'm gonna land on 8 as well for myself. Thank goodness Mr. Walker isn't here to provide a counterpoint, because I suspect he would not agree, nor would my car probably, which is now has some electronic monitoring of something. Anyway, all right, question 2. What is your favorite carbohydrate of this list? Bread, rice, pasta, or potatoes, Rhonda?
So a version of potatoes, French fries.
Oh, I have to say, my real answer is all of the above. But if I have to pick one, I would say warm, fresh bread with butter is my favorite.
It is hard to argue with fresh bread, sourdough bread, but I'm going to go with potatoes. I've become a big fan of all things sweet potatoes, Japanese sweet potatoes. There's a lot of fun to be had there, but that's a whole nother discussion. Okay. Question number 3, a little work related. Do you keep a paper or electronic to-do list and calendar? Rhonda?
Oh, all electronic.
I'm a hybrid. I have a paper to-do list and an electronic calendar.
Well, we have something else in common, Anna. We've talked about this on the podcast before. I went to a paper to-do list 2 or 3 years ago, having been all electronic like Rhonda. So I am paper for to-do. For some reason, that helps me get things done. I don't know why. And electronic for calendar. And then question 4. On an airplane, and I know you've been traveling a lot, Anna. Do you prefer the aisle seat or the window seat? That's question part 1, but part 2 is the key one, is how about your spouse and how do you manage that when you travel together? Rhonda?
So I prefer the aisle because I'm a little claustrophobic. But I usually defer and let my husband sit there because he's taller and has longer legs. So I just deal with the trauma and sit next to the window.
And he never hears about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, I never complain. I'm such a good wife.
Well, I'm an aisle person for sure. I'm a little taller and my husband is also tall. And so when we travel together now, it took us a while to get to this point, but we do aisle. We'll sit across the aisle from each other.
Okay.
And that works out really well. And a lot of times the flight attendants get a kick out of it because a lot of times we'll hold hands across the aisle and until the food cart comes or people have to pass by. But that works well for us.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I love that story.
I do too.
And Rhonda, that is something for you to talk to Mr. Wood about.
I will.
The aisle strategy. Well, as it works out, I am all about the aisle seat and Mr. Walker is all about the window seat. And so I guess we are a pretty good match that way. And that concludes our lightning round. There are no prizes. I'm sorry. But I hope you all enjoyed it. And I will turn it over to my friend to close us out.
Yeah. So that concludes another episode of Lady Justice Women of the Court. And thank you again, Chief Justice Anna Blackburn Rigsby from the District of Columbia. And special thanks to our new friends at the National Center for State Courts for partnering with us. And we look forward to spreading education and information about state courts and how they work and how important they are. And Beth and I will be back very soon with another episode. In the meantime, you can follow us on social media or Lady Justice on your favorite podcast app. So I hope everybody has a good day. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lady Justice, Women of the Court. To learn more about the work of our nation's state courts, visit the National Center for State Courts online at ncsc.org. Follow Lady Justice, Women of the Court on social media and subscribe to the show on podcast platforms to receive notifications about new episodes.